And the will of God is absolute, and it can cut through all the veils of separation, if it is His will. If we say yes. And as the Sufis say, if it is the right time and the right place and the right people. Those three have to come together. But we have access through the heart of hearts, through our devotion, through our purity, through our aspiration, to this pure wine of remembrance, to this pure wine of the knowledge of God. That is the feminine pole of the path. The pure wine of remembrance. And there is also the sword of Allah that cuts through everything, that imprints His will right into the manifest world. It can do it in your life. Many of you have experienced it. You say yes, He takes your life, He breaks it in two, He puts the pieces back together in a way you couldn't even imagine. And why can't He do it to His world? Why do we have to belong to the politicians? Why does the world have to belong to the politicians, to the corporate executives, when we know it belongs to God? We know it. It is the absolute truth. Of course the world belongs to God. Who else is it going to belong to? Who else's world is it? And if we carry that consciousness in our hearts and in our minds, because human beings are such extraordinary organisms, because they have all the planes of manifestation within them. On the highest plane, we have access to the absolute, which is even beyond all the planes of non-being. We have access to the absolute. And our feet, hopefully, are on the ground. We participate in everyday life. This has always been part of the Sufi tradition. We have never been allowed to be hermits. But not many of us were allowed to be hermits, or not for long. 40-day retreat, that's what you get. You know, if you're a good Tibetan, you get 9 years in a cave, it's great. They lock you up, bowl of rice every 2 days, lots of practices. Sufis, we are householders, we are married, we are part of life, we are part of the game of life. Sometimes we are driven crazy by it. Sometimes it makes fun of us. It does things we don't want it to do, but we are part of it. And it needs us. Not just in abstraction, but with each and every breath, the cycle of creation is repeated. The cycle of He loves them and they love Him flows through our blood. And through this, the will of God can come directly from the innermost plane of non-being, even beyond the plane of manifestation, where in the innermost planes there is not even the limitation of manifestation. There are no thought forms, there are no ideas, there are no images, there are not even any names. It is even beyond the names. It comes like an arrow, like a sword, right through His servant. We are in service to there is no God but God, to the absolute oneness of life, to the completeness that is within us and is within life. And if it is His will, only if it is His will, it can be given back to life. Life can once again open and become joyful and become a celebration rather than hard work, rather than effort. People work too hard. On the inner planes, it is much easier. Light flows to light. Joy is there. Peace is there. Bliss is there. It's all there. Here you have to make an effort. You're always misunderstood. But on this plane, something can happen that can't happen on the inner planes. His face can be reflected. There He is hidden. Here His face can be revealed. All the world loves you, but you are nowhere to be found, hidden and yet completely obvious. That's Rumi. And Ibn al-Arabi says the same thing. How can I know you when you are the inwardly hidden who is not known? How can I not know you when you are the outwardly manifest who makes yourself known to me in everything? It is so beautiful. How can I know you when you are the inwardly hidden who is not known? How can I not know you when you are the outwardly manifest who makes yourself known to me in everything? So friends, let's live it. Let's take a chance. Let's say maybe life can wake up. Maybe his revelation can happen here. Maybe he can witness himself in every moment of every day on this plane of manifestation. Not in some far transcendent reality. Not just inwardly within the heart, but outwardly. And then his signs that are in life will wake up. And we will see life for what it really is. A garden of revelation that is continually unfolding, unfolding in love and beauty and terror and horror and everything that are all the qualities of our beloved, because he is not just nice, he is not just beautiful, he is terrible too. He is all merciful but all powerful. And we are his servants. And we are here in service to our beloved. Because what else is there to do? What else can make life meaningful? What else can give joy to the heart but to know you are in service to Allah, to your beloved? So friends, we have a 5-minute break. And then we have time for questions.
Hi. You described the world in two different ways. One, it's sort of frivolous and full of illusion and
Mia.
And the other one is we're in a constant state of divine revelation and we are God. And
which would you like?
Yeah. You could sort of help me hold the two at the same time, combine those images or somehow.
That's why Sufis are tricksters, you see. Seriously, it's a very serious question. And I could give a very serious answer. I could talk about primary causes and secondary causes. I've even written a chapter in one of my books about it. I can't remember that now, but... But I think, really, to live a mystical life, you have to be a juggler. You have to learn how to... how to play with life. You see, if you take it too seriously, it'll either become very serious or it'll totally misbehave. But sometimes you don't notice it's misbehaving. You think it's an accident or something. Or a sign, you know. It's just misbehaving. But, you know, yes, sometimes life is quite banal. It's like an aeroplane journey, you know. I read mystery thrillers on aeroplane journeys. And you live it. And you do your spiritual practice, you do your remembrance, you do your zikr. Well, sometimes you forget to do the zikr. Sometimes you forget to remember, you know. Somebody gave me this lovely expression yesterday, in this culture we have weapons of mass distraction. And yet, somewhere there also, you know your beloved is present. It is, Mrs. Tweedy used to often quote this Italian love song about holding love with light hands. It is, well, I guess, you know, it's easier for a man because if you fall in love with a woman, you have to learn how to kind of play with these veils of illusion, you know, that that seems so natural to women. I think it's Rumi who says, a woman is God shining through subtle veils. So we get used to the whole ambiguity of it, that it isn't quite what it appears to be or what it says it means or... And all I can tell you is, you know, there's a sort of more serious expression Mrs. Tweedy used to say about being a soldier of the two worlds. But one can also be a juggler of the two worlds. One can be a fool of the two worlds. And it is always really the practice is always to be attentive somewhere. Somewhere you are always attentive. Whatever you are doing, whatever, whether it's interesting or boring, you are always attentive just in case your beloved wants to reveal himself at that moment. Because it doesn't always happen. You know, it may surprise you, mystics, even professional mystics like myself. I get paid for being a mystic, you don't. I'm on the mystical lecture circuit, you know. Even professional mystics don't always live in a continual state of ecstasy and bliss. Of course, we always have access to it, but... you know, a lot of time life is just life. And it's very important. It's actually one of the very, very first spiritual teachings I was ever given years and years ago, in which I had a dream experience in which I was taken into the presence of my sheikh, of Baisab's sheikh. And he showed me a movie of himself as a young man, and he was flying a kite. And it gave me that teaching from a very, very early age, you have to have your feet on the ground. It's very important to be involved in the banalities of life. Otherwise, you can get caught in spiritual illusions. And spiritual illusions are a whole different ball game. I don't want to talk about it now because it's a whole subject of spiritual illusions. But a lot of the time one just lives life. And at the same time you keep this place of awareness, of constant attention, because you never know when your beloved either wants your attention somewhere else. Sometimes you just get pulled. He needs your attention for something. Or he wants to show you something here. He wants to reveal himself here. And so, in the end, it's a bit like riding a bicycle. At the beginning, it's almost impossible. And you fall over and you miss every opportunity. And later, it becomes second nature and you learn how to keep those balls in the air. And it works. Because, why? Because mystics have been doing it for centuries. Yeah, but it's a very important question. Thank you. Yeah, over here. Just wait, and then we get the microphone and we do it. Ben's got this microphone, he's longing to hand it out, you see, otherwise it can just be.
Llewellyn, when you were talking, you said something about how, in terms of the surrender to God, that the inner world reflects the outer world and the outer world reflects the inner.
It's very beautiful.
And what I was wondering about that is, I've had the experience where if you actually surrender in that sort of way or align your life with some very deep aspect of reality, it also seems like the inner and the outer worlds come into alignment as
correct.
Well in terms of the content.
Absolutely correct.
And what I was wondering is if you had any thought about that in terms of people that experience synchronicities. And the particular question that I had is whether when that happens, it has seemed to me in the past that the synchronicities themselves are not necessarily guides in themselves that you would necessarily read in that sort of way, but that they're actually indications that you're on the right path. And I was wondering if you had any thoughts about that.
Yeah, I mean, first of all, the term synchronicity, I'm a bit of a Jungian scholar. I mean, I did my PhD in Jungian psychology, and synchronicity actually has a specific meaning. It was termed by Jung. It has to do with the fact that when the unconscious is activated in a very, very powerful way, it constellates itself on the outer planes. And that is different to the inner and outer coming together. It has to do with the unconscious being powerful enough to manifest itself externally in your life, and that's what you have. Inner and outer coming together is a much more, has to do with the flow. I think you experience it most when ordinary things become profoundly meaningful, rather than having signposts or guidance or anything like that. It's like everything becomes steeped in meaning. Picking up a glass of water and drinking it, you are participating in the whole mystery of life. And it can happen in the most ordinary way. You hear a bird singing, and it is unbelievably beautiful. You even, I've had a number of very deep experiences in airports, I think, because I used to fly a lot, and it was kind of being taken out of my normal surroundings. And there the inner and the outer seemed to come together for me, and I saw this, what on one level is very banal, ordinary, everyday life, being steeped in the mystery with the imprint of something else. It's of course very, very individual and very unique how we experience it. But I think for me it has also to do with joy, because joy is a spontaneous expression of the divine in the moment, in life. And when I have a feeling, and this may be just spiritual fantasy, but I don't think so. I have a feeling that there are tremendous energy shifts taking place at the moment, and this has to do with the inner and the outer being aligned together for the first time in very many millennia. And they used to be quite separate. In order to go to a certain plane, you had to go deep into meditation, and there it was. And it is now just coming like a dawn over the horizon. And I have a feeling that one of the signs of this happening is joy returning to life. We have forgotten about joy. We've been following pleasure and enjoyment, and sadly even spiritual pleasure and spiritual enjoyment. But joy is something quite different. Joy is a natural expression of the divine in life. You just feel great to be alive. And one of the wonderful things I actually love about America, being here and being a resident alien, you have a certain bonus, because is that it is a culture that actually, whether knowingly or unknowingly, celebrates that. It may be very, very materialistic, but it is a yes culture. I know, because I come from England, which is a kind of maybe and it's not worth it anyway culture. But this culture has this enormous primal energy that is just waiting to burst into celebration of life.
Thank you for answering that. As a final question, why do you think it is that the modern world has been, I like your point about the joy and the affirmation and everything like that, but why do you think it is that the modern world has become so disenchanted in many ways, and that people have followed the lead of, you know, the marketing people and all of that?
Because we're in a shift, and it's a sign of every end of every civilization. I used to study T.S. Eliot. He talks about it very much, about where are the signs? There are only a heap of broken images. And it is one of the signs of the end of an era. I actually wrote a book about it called The Signs of God, because it is not really understood that the signs of God change. The way they were revealed, they shift. The archetypes change. This has to do with it's a long story. It has to do with the evolution of the human psyche. It has to do with the shift we are going through from the number 7 to the number 8. But what happens at the end of any cycle and the time of transition is the old things that used to give meaning to life have gone. And the new, and they are so new, it is not really understood how new they are. The new qualities, the new revelation of the divine has not yet taken form. This is why certain things can happen now that couldn't have happened 100 years ago and probably won't be able to happen 100 years in the future. And that is why I feel our role as mystics, as those who belong to God, has a pivotal role to play, because we can bring down the highest level of consciousness right into this life, which can have a dramatic effect about how the future becomes constellated. And one of the signs of the end of the era is a disenchantment, but it is also a time, what it means is the old forms are no longer there. And you can either complain about it or you can realize this is a time of incredible opportunity, because one can reconstellate the next stage of evolution at the highest level possible. And for the Sufis, this has to do with the oneness of God, the conscious oneness of God being brought down into everyday life so that it resonates throughout the whole of creation. Yeah? Yeah, over here.
Thank you so much, Sheikh, for your explanations. The point about human beings not controlling very much, and that we have to accept what comes to us, is very hard for our society to accept, because we think we control everything.
Really?
But once...
Where do you live?
My Sheikha said one time, this explanation that if you hear something good or something not so good, you should say Alhamdulillah. By that you turn over the problem to Allah to resolve.
Of course.
And so it goes along with what you have been saying.
Yes, of
and
course.
Thank you so much.
Thank you. It's beautifully put. Beautifully.
My question is...
Can you speak a little bit more into the microphone?
Okay, is that better?
That's much better, yeah.
In the moment, throughout the course of your day, when you find yourself stuck, whether it's a moment of just forgetting, mm-hmm. or something is happening that doesn't seem to be going mm-hmm. well, what do you do? What are the tools that you use, the basic tools, to clear the lines of communication between you and Allah, to then be listening again and to be really receiving that guidance? Are there some very basic things that you could speak to us that you consistently find yourself going back to?
Okay, I mean, I can give you a very straight, you asked me a personal question, you see. You say, what do I do? What do I do is I connect with my higher self and I say, what's going on? But that's because I've been trained to do that. On a more mundane level, first of all, who is stuck? You know, is it because it is something that's happening to you that you don't want to happen to you? You know, the danger of trying to rectify a situation is that you are immediately saying it shouldn't be like that. And, you know, that's a very, if one is really on the path of surrender, one should, first of all, try to surrender to the situation. It may appear you are stuck. It may appear you have made a mistake, but, you know, a very wise old friend of mine, she used to say, there are no such thing as good and bad experiences. There are only experiences. And what matters is what you do with the experience that life has given you. You may say it is a human failing, but that is part of the mystery of being a human being, to fail. You see, the beloved is perfect. We are not. And it is part of, I think, in my experience, the wonder of being here in this world is we make a mess. And sometimes we have to learn to clear the mess up, and sometimes we have to learn how to live with a mess, and to embrace chaos, and to be driven crazy. And sometimes we need discipline and learn how to clear it up. But so first of all, I think you want to be very careful about trying to rectify a situation unless you get a clear hint that it isn't as it should be. And then we just pray. We say, beloved, help me. You know, Mrs. Tweedy used to say, you know, we do, on our path, we do this silent zikr that's done 24 hours a day. And she said, you know, you will forget. But when you remember, don't blame yourself for remembering, for forgetting, because that is the ego. I should have known better. Just thank the beloved for reminding you. You see, it is the attitude. I am here in service to you. I make a mess. Luckily, we are forgiven and forgiven and forgiven. There is a lovely story that belongs both to the Jewish and to the Muslim history, in which the people came to Moses and they said to Moses, does God pray? And Moses says, well, I don't know. Does God pray? I don't know if God prays, you know. God is God. God is absolute. God is that. But anyway, next time he was with God, you know, he asked the question. He says, God, do you pray? And God said, of course I pray. And my prayer is always, may my mercy be greater than my justice. That is his prayer. Luckily for our sakes. Yeah. Yes, behind.
Hi. Could you speak a little bit about the nature of the veil of patriarchy?
Wow, you really want that one this evening.
Maybe a little bit, a little bit.
The nature of the veil of the patriarchy.
And maybe in relation, because you've been speaking a lot about the Sufi as a servant and the beloved.
Why do you want to know?
I need to know.
What?
I need to know.
You need to know. Well, what happens is over time, human beings being what they are, certain structures get built up. And in this last cycle, a certain power has been given to the masculine. In the previous cycle, it belonged to the feminine. In this cycle, it has been given to the masculine, and it had to do with what was needed to evolve consciousness in a particular way, to give a certain clarity and individuality to consciousness. And it could only be done through the masculine, because the masculine has the ability to detach. And it also had to do with the evolution of civilization that is always a reflection of the evolution of consciousness. But humanity has the wonderful ability to corrupt that which is given and to take the power, because what through that evolution of consciousness, through that masculine alignment, humanity was given the possibility to realize the transcendent nature of God. And that has to do with all the recognition that he is one and absolute. And because before then, in the matriarchal eras, the transcendent nature of God was a secret held by initiates, but was not part of collective consciousness. So over the last few thousand years, in order to realize, to come to know, in order for that aspect of God to be revealed, a certain energy was given to masculine consciousness. And that energy should be used for man's relationship to God, for mankind's relationship to God. But he gave humanity this gift of free will, which means, I'm going to give you a certain energy, you do with it as you will. And so what should be used, because consciousness, the evolution of consciousness, has to do with our evolving relationship to God. Because that is what it says. Am I not your Lord? And they answered, yes, we witness it. And that is the function of consciousness, the witnessing of God. But how much of that masculine energy has been used to witness God? And how much has it been used to create structures of repression and power? And that is part of the dark side of humanity, the way the ego takes the light that is given for spiritual evolution and uses it for its own purposes, for the naps, for its own power purposes. And then the purity gets corrupted. Then the organization takes over. And the song gets lost, the beauty gets lost. That is why Idris Shah says Sufis never found an organization that's intended to endure. It has to be able to go with the wind, because otherwise it exists too much. It is caught too much in the structures of existence. And then it gets caught in politics and power and money and corruption, and it forgets the inner alignment of the soul to God. And sadly, that has happened a lot in, not just in corporate structures, but also in spiritual structures. They have become aligned, they have become used for the purpose of power, for the purposes of ego, and sadly, for the purposes of a spiritual ego. And a spiritual ego is a very dangerous thing. It is quite powerful on the inner planes, and it can influence people against their will, which is quite different to the total freedom that belongs to the Sufi path, which is aligned only with the will of God. Is that a good enough answer? You want more? Yes, at the front. I get carried away sometimes, you must.
I'd like to thank you for this session. It really seems like maybe you were looking at my face and talking about the session, taking it so seriously. Difficulty myself, you know, I totally agree with you that we make it so heavy for ourselves. But when you really look around, you know, the books that we read on Sufism
or Nasruddin?
I'm sorry?
Nasruddin?
Except for Nasruddin Mullah.
You can't study Sufism without reading Nasruddin.
That's right.
Who is the donkey? You know the story of smuggling donkeys, you know? Sorry, go on.
No, I really appreciate you bringing this lightness, and my really, I don't know for myself, I feel like when I read these books, there is so much that is asked of you to be a good disciple, a disciplined disciple.
Yeah.
And even the fact that you mentioned that you submit.
You have to submit.
Which we do, but yet still, somehow that seriousness still stays with you, and that
total seriousness, yeah, it is completely serious. There is nothing more serious. Your blood is on the table, yeah.
But why actually then some of us become so serious that, you know, when we go away from it, that everything else we start to take seriously as well, yes, and don't really lighten up?
Don't lighten up, yeah. You know, I'm an example. I was a very serious spiritual student.
You know, I can tell that.
Yeah, and then, you know, one day I had this dream or this vision, and there was a coffin, and on which was written spiritual aspirant.
I don't want to see that for myself either.
Because it is an aspect of the beloved. He is full of laughter. There is so much joy, there is so much laughter. Sometimes, you know, when I take myself too seriously, and then I just tune into my sheikh somewhere, and he's laughing and laughing and laughing, you know? Because somebody had a dream in our group in which they were told about the last great spiritual secret. And it is kept secret. Why? Because there isn't a secret. But then you have this other side. I wanted to, because I love this dream, which is very serious. This is a friend in New York had a little while ago. I was sitting on the edge of my bed in silent prayer. I suddenly had this outrageous thought in the form of a prayer. Please, beloved, may I receive a sign of your friendship. Then I slipped into bed and relaxed into sleep. I was still only dozing in that state between asleep and somewhat conscious, when in a dream I found myself standing facing a vast expanse. From afar, a man was coming to me. Closer, he was almost naked, magnificent, a David of Michelangelo, but more mature. He came straight at me, immensely powerful, like an archangel, a short sword in his hand, and obviously meaning business. It was an impersonal, mesmerizing sight. Upon reaching me, he grabbed my wrist, killed me, tore my heart out of my chest, turned around, and raising his arms, offered it to God. Terrified and in awe, I awoke. My first thought was, better be very, very careful about what you ask.
Wow.
It's real, yes, it's your blood. And if you can't laugh about it, you won't make it.
Sure.
Because why? Because the ego will get hold of the whole business. That's one of the reasons you need a sheikh. At that moment, when you begin to take yourself too seriously, when you begin to take your aspirations too seriously, to turn a trick about you, to make fun of you in public, you know? And then you realize, yes, it was the ego getting hold. That's what I'm saying about the danger of a spiritual ego. It is very dangerous. The ego becomes spiritualized. You become, you know, a wayfarer on the path, and you have the right attitude and the right clothes and, you know, a meaningful relationship and all of that. And you probably have, you know. And it isn't about that at all. It's about a love affair. If you take a love affair too seriously, you know what happens. You get married. But Sufis are renowned for laughing. You know, if you go to a Sufi gathering, I tell you a lovely story. It's a bit of a digression, but you know, Mrs. Tweedy, her teacher, Baisab, my sheikh, he died and she came back to England. And after about 15 years, she had a dream or a vision. And she was told in this dream, go to Morocco, turn left, go on a bus inland, I think it was to Fez. And then she saw some tiled roofs. And she says, and she was told, there you'll find a Sufi. So, being obedient, she flew to Morocco, she turned left, she went inland, she got a bus, and apparently, I haven't been there, so I don't know, but many of you probably have. In that part of the world, most of the houses are flat, most of the roofs are flat. So she was driving along in the bus, all the villages had flat roofs. Suddenly, looking out of the bus, she saw the tiled roofs of a village, and it was a village in her dream, in her vision. So she said to the bus driver, I want to get off. And he says, you can't. The bus goes all the way over there to Fez. You don't stop here. But she made such a row, they threw her off the bus. And anyway, she went into this village, and she said, you know, they said, it was a sort of village where Western women, you know, particularly 65-year-old Western women or 70-year-old Western women don't come. And they said, you know, what are you doing here? And she said, I've come to visit the Sufi sheikh. And he said, there isn't a Sufi sheikh around here. You know, so they found her a sort of hotel. And, you know, you draw a bit of a crowd there. And anyway, she started to tell this story, this vision. So being sensible people, they took it seriously. And one young boy went off, and he asked around, and he came back a couple of hours later, and he says, well, in the next village over there, there is Sufi. And so the next day, it was late that evening, the next day they got into a taxi, her, the little boy, and the policeman. For some reason, the policeman had to come. And they went off to this village, and there was a mosque, and it was noontime, and everybody was having a siesta, so she waited. And then they said, yes, you know, the sheikh is up. And then she went to the door of the mosque, because she was not Muslim and she was a woman. She wasn't allowed inside the mosque. But she looked in through the door, and there she saw this man, and she said, he was dressed in white, he was fat, and he was laughing, so she knew he was a Sufi. And he asked the person, there was in French, said, you know, why has this person come? Why has this woman come? And the guide translated that she'd had a vision of a Sufi sheikh, and she had to come to this village. And so he said, yes, and he looked at her, and he looked at her for 3 or 4 minutes, and he did something. He was inside the mosque, she was at the door. He did something to her heart chakra, and then he said, va, go. And that was it. Because her sheikh wasn't in the physical body, something needed to be done to her heart chakra, so she was sent to the nearest sheikh of a similar lineage who could do that. And then she went off, she actually went to Konya, a bit of traveling. But I love that. She said, you know, he was dressed in white, he was fat, and he was laughing, so she knew he was a Sufi.
Well, thank you for that. You know, it certainly helps to take life a little bit more
take
light.
Take yourself not so seriously. It is the danger, this is very serious. The danger is when you take the ego, and particularly the spiritual ego, seriously.
Can I ask one other question?
Why not? You have the microphone.
You left it kind of open, and maybe I missed it. You said something about being at the right place, at the right time, with the right people.
Absolutely. That is the Sufi saying, three have to come together. It has to be the right place, the right time, and the right people. Absolutely correct. Next question. There's nothing to say, it's just the way it is. It has to be, if it's the right place and the right time, but there aren't the right people, it doesn't happen. Yes, the lady in the front, in the bright blue.
Thank you. Well, I have a problem.
No.
I don't really understand why you always refer to God with the personal pronoun.
He.
Yes. Even if it was she, which would be a different experience, you know, I wonder why you or we don't refer to God as just that or source. Why use
why
this?
I?
Yeah, I or you personally.
I can tell you why I do.
Yeah?
Because I'm not very good at having love affairs with it.
Uh-huh.
You know? And what is fascinating, you see, then you'd say, well, I'm a man, I should refer to it. The beloved as she, but this is an esoteric mystery, is that the soul before God is always feminine. And this is a lovely historical example of this. And this is the Indian mystic Mirabai. I'm sure you've heard of her. She was a God-intoxicated mystic, and she danced in the forest for Krishna. And there is a story, she came to a temple to Krishna in the forest, and it was a bit patriarchal in those days in India. And there was a famous ascetic, and he was living there at the temple, and he wouldn't let her in because she was a woman. And he looked at her, she looked at him, and she said, are not all souls feminine before God? And he knew she was right, so he let her in. Yeah. When you are taken in love, when your beloved comes to you and just fills you with bliss and intoxication, and you know, then it is your beloved. It is your beloved, and for me it is he. He is my beloved. At that moment, he is my beloved. I would do anything for him, and he is my beloved. Of course, the beloved has a tremendous feminine side, and this is, for me, this is part of the whole mystery of creation. This is the Maya, the goddess, and it is unbelievable. A woman is God shining through subtle veils. These are the veils of the beloved all around us. And what beauty and terror. Because The feminine, you may not know, but I know, the feminine has a terrible side too. A dark, destructive, violent side. It says in the Song of Solomon's, I think, as terrible as an army with banners. She is as terrible, as beautiful as the moon, that's the right quotation. As beautiful as the moon and as terrible as an army with banners. And if you think what it meant in those times when an army with banners came, you were going to get raped and slaughtered. It was not a pleasant sight. Yeah, that is our beloved. He does to us what he wills. And we say yes, and we say yes, and we say yes. And we say yes again. It's a wonderful thing to belong to God, to know that he is the boss. Like Mrs. Tweedy said, you're a yes man to God. Yes, sir. You do what he wants. You say yes. You are my beloved. I am your servant. I don't care about anything else, about the seven worlds, about all those virgins in paradise, or apparently it's a mistranslation, they're white pearls or something, but... All those, it doesn't matter. Like Rabia says, we are here just for his sake. And you can offer them, somebody anything. See again, all this thing about power. Who cares about power when you belong to God? He has power, absolute authority, and so much love. You are drowned and drowned again. If you want it, if you are prepared to pay the price. And there's a very, very little price. It just happens to be yourself. So friends, God bless, a lovely evening together, and sleep well, dream beautiful dreams, or pray all night, whatever is your particular practice. And we meet again tomorrow. Yeah.